At the heart of Vedic, or certainly of Hindu philosophy, thought, theology, is a piece of literature called the Bhagavad Gita. I know that our interviewee today, Gauralila Dasa, Guido von Arx in Zurich, Switzerland, would recoil at the notion, but to oversimplify it, the Bhagavad Gita is to Hinduism what the Bible is to Christianity and Judaism. Gauralila, why do you have problems with that parallel or that comparison? What is the Bhagavad Gita that makes it different from the Bible?
My little problem is the word or the terminology Hindu, because it kind of just limits a certain philosophy or religion to one particular country. And I personally see the Bhagavad Gita more as a universal spiritual book, which shouldn't be limited to a Hindu belief. But otherwise, you know, those who have a liking and an understanding for the Bhagavad Gita, they don't mind how it's called for them. It's what the Bhagavad Gita is, the Song of God. And the Song of God is not limited to Hinduism or Christianity. Whoever is willing to hear that song will hear it, whether he's Hindu, Christian, Muslim, or even atheist.
Okay, well, you know the Bhagavad Gita intimately. And I'm wondering about this idea of a comparison. If we look at the content, the structure, the thematics of the two, the Bhagavad Gita and the Bible, at least the Old Testament of the Christian Judaic Bible. Do you see parallels there? Can it be compared at all?
Maybe if you look at the element around the Bhagavad Gita, the Mahabharata, which is like the story setting of this dialogue, you could make certain comparisons. However, the Gita itself, I would say, goes beyond the Old Testament. God is not something like a person who deals with the elements of envy and destruction. Although when you look at the more superficial level of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna may seem to have similar characteristics. However, the depth of it and the actual goal of it is loving devotion and not destruction of an enemy.
Okay, well, let's open the Bhagavad Gita and see what's in it. What does it contain? What is the Bhagavad Gita?
The Bhagavad Gita is a dialogue between Lord Krishna, who was coming on this planet especially to help his devotees, and you could say his friend and also later his disciple Arjuna, who was in a crisis. You could imagine the situation. Arjuna was by nature, by education, by training, a warrior. However, when one day he had to face a battle and the enemies were his guru, his teacher, and his cousins, understandingly, he became very weak and morose. And in that situation, when actually tears came out of his eyes, he approached his charioteer. It was a very uncommon position for the Lord of the universe to become the charioteer of his friend Arjuna. However, this shows that Krishna doesn't have an ego, because actually, charioteer is like the chauffeur, a low-class job in the Vedic times, especially when a war takes place. But Krishna didn't feel himself too low to be with Arjuna and help him in that crisis. And that dialogue means the questions of Arjuna in a situation of despair, and the answers of Lord Krishna became the Song of God, or called in Sanskrit, the Bhagavad Gita.
Now, Arjuna was about to do battle with his family. It was a family affair, a family feud.
Fratricidal war.
Exactly. That's the correct term. And so what was on Arjuna's mind? What were his questions to Lord Krishna?
You see, both armies were standing on the two sides and ready to start the battle. But before they really marched into each other and, you know, were fighting, Arjuna requested Krishna to bring him in between the two armies. He wanted to see with who is fighting. It's, as a warrior, you have to know who you're fighting, and you have to actually have anger and hatred. Then you're inspired and you're motivated. If that's lacking, then you can't fight. So Arjuna,
in modern times, we have spy satellites and we have propaganda programs to whip up hatred against the enemy and to find out what they're doing.
And ultimately, that's the same which happened at that time, of course, in a much more simple way. So it's really well we could imagine the situation when suddenly you have to face a job and you become overwhelmed with sentiments. I would maybe take a more easier example to understand Arjuna's situation. Let's say you're a tax collector and your duty is to collect money on behalf of the government. One day you have to go to your friends and relatives and family members. And suddenly you feel a bit strange about that job. And you start to philosophize. Actually, why should I take money from people? Isn't it better to give money to people? And you start the whole thing, I want to be an altruist person, I don't want to take money from people, and you want to leave the job. So when people hear about the situation that Arjuna was unwilling to fight and approach Krishna, what shall I do now? I don't want to fight, I give up fighting. I rather become a monk, renounce all this battling and warrior style and being a prince and a king. Krishna questions his motives, not his action. And more important, coming back to the example of a tax collector, is that you do your duty without questioning the results and make sure you're not doing your job either out of sentimentalism or fanatism. And if you want to boil down the Gita, it's not talking against non-violence, or it's also not talking for violence, but it's talking against these two things. That you're not doing an activity out of sentimentalism or fanatism. We had before Arjuna was standing in the middle of the two armies and was overwhelmed with sentimental feelings about his duty he's supposed to fight with. We had the leader of the opposite side, Duryodhana, in the same situation. He came in front and wanted to see his enemies. His reaction was different. You could consider him the archetype of the fanatical person. Even though he saw his cousins were on the other side, his relatives were on the other side, his determination didn't waver. By all means, he wanted to fight and he wanted the kingdom, and he was ready to do that by killing his cousins. So for him was the fanatical side, not considering time, place and circumstance, not considering emotional sides. For his Arjuna, he lost his duty mentality and his heart started to bleed, so to say, why should I fight?
Well, some would say that Arjuna was on the road to enlightenment. He saw what he was doing and saw that it was something bad that he couldn't live with anymore. So how did Krishna react to this?
I want to recall, Krishna questioned the motivations. He didn't care ultimately, or the point wasn't whether Arjuna would fight or not fight, but whatever he does, whether it's not fighting or fighting, should be done with knowledge based on discrimination, not his personal whims or, you could say, sentimental feelings for the moment. That has to be transcended. That was the question, because ultimately when Krishna started to ask Arjuna about the motivation he came out, it wasn't the pure altruistic, warm-hearted, kind-hearted Arjuna who didn't want to fight, but Arjuna was scared that his good name, which he had as a respected gentleman and prince and fighter, would be ruined when people later would hear Arjuna kill this guru.
So in other words, a strong element of false ego was involved here.
Attachment.
Yeah.
Attachment, which is always a problem. Even if you're attached to something good, you will face sooner or later trouble, because that something good will be temporary. One day it will be taken away from you.
So let's take this step by step now as we begin to understand the content or the structure of the Bhagavad Gita. Arjuna saying, I repent, I repent, I renounce all of this. This is terrible. This isn't right. Warfare, this killing, this is not for me. It sounds good up to this point. But then Krishna comes in and says, well, what are your motivations for saying that? And then we start seeing flaws in the reasoning. It is not purely selfless. It is not simply altruistic. It does not indicate a true, pure state of development. He had, as we would say, ulterior motives. And they were, in a way, really selfish motives. Sounds good on the one hand, but it was still flawed. That's basically it, right?
That's why you
And Krishna blew his cover, as we say today, and helped him to see himself what he was doing, Arjuna.
It's practically impossible to understand the Gita if you remain on a superficial platform. And Krishna forced Arjuna and hopefully us as well to just see beyond the superficial platform, because non-violence always sounds good. But these uncomfortable questions which Krishna asked to Arjuna revealed it, both to Arjuna and of course the audience, that Arjuna's motivations were wrong, and that's why Krishna questioned them.
Well, if this were a play or a movie summary, we'd be talking about 3 or 4 pages. But the Bhagavad Gita is more involved than that. There's a copy over there on the shelf. It's a substantial book. So what happens? We have the basic storyline now, to use that term. What happens between the covers?
Actually, the Bhagavad Gita itself is a very short book. It only contains 700 verses. It's called a philosophical verse or prosa form.
But it's still more than 3 or 4 pages.
It's a little bit, the whole conversation took maybe about 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. However, it's very concise. You could even call it, it's aphorism. In very short words, deep meanings were exchanged. Especially Krishna is not the person who's talking big words, many words, blah, blah, blah. Mm. He's not saying much, but what he says has deep meaning. That's why Bhagavad Gita is a book one can study again and again and never gets actually tired or feels it's repetitive or I heard it before, because it's so much depth. Mm. And Bhagavad Gita has, of course, different levels. It has the story level, which is the lowest level. Story you can always explain, these friends and these relatives and cousins, fratricidal war, families, etc. Then there is the more emotional level. We heard about Arjuna's emotions, how he felt facing his guru, facing his teachers, facing his relatives, and how he reacted to that. And then comes the more subtle metaphysical level. What happens between the three-dimensional world we are able to perceive with our senses and higher elements which are also involved and sometimes intervene. And ultimately, which is the most important point, but simultaneously the most subtle point, is the spiritual level. Because this war is a very external, you could say, the most tragic or the most difficult, the most serious situation one can face. Normally we face simpler situations, not as severe, not as heavy as someone who has to fight his cousins. We maybe do not want to fulfill another duty. I'm too lazy to get up in the morning to do my job. Or I don't want to do another kind of duty I'm supposed to. And Krishna just chose the most tragic situation, just to make everyone aware. It can't be more tragic than that.
Well, I was going to ask you why he chose a soldier. I mean, there were so many occupations, professions, individuals in the world. Is anything revealed why it should be Arjuna the soldier?
There are several reasons. When you look at the Vedas, there are actually, all of them are conversations, questions and answers. And generally, wise people, priests, talk to kshatriyas, to kings. And I think the reason is, in one sense, the rulers of the world, at least externally, are the kings, the kshatriyas, as they are called. They manifest power, they manifest rulership, they manifest boldness, ability to rule and guide humanity. But behind those kshatriyas, those rulers, are the priests. But they externally appear very feeble, very weak, physically not very attractive, not very powerful, not very wealthy. These are the kshatriyas. Now, the second reason why Krishna talked to Arjuna, he said that in the Gita itself, because you're my friend and you're not envious. He said it's impossible to understand the mystery, or you could say the spiritual content or message of the Gita, if you're envious. So it's a quality, which a certain spiritual quality, which is required in order to understand the depth or the mystery of the Bhagavad Gita. So these two reasons, I would say, is why Krishna chose Arjuna, plus the situation Arjuna was in, just perfectly suited in order to make that point clear, that you have to question the motivation, not the activity. Ultimately, the activity is the secondary aspect, but with which motivation you perform your activity.
Now, how is the Gita structured? I mean, if we use the term literarily, I mean, how is it broken up? How is it separated, chapters and verses? How is it put together?
So there are in total 700 verses. Some say that before there were a little bit more than 700, but now we got 700 verses. It's divided into 18 chapters. And you can say the Gita is divided into three elements. It discusses three processes of yoga. Now, yoga means a little bit more than just physical exercising and certain breathing techniques which we learn in the West. Yoga in the Sanskrit term actually means the connection, the link between the soul and the supreme soul. Or you can say...
Or unity us, between the two.
Yeah, yeah. Unity between us and God, and there are different processes, different paths. Mm. So you can do certain elements maybe of self-control, and sattvic means life in goodness through physical exercises in order to have your body involved in more harmonious way. It's probably ideal for people who are very much in a bodily consciousness. However, the Gita deals very little with that element. It's just slightly touched in the sixth chapter, but mainly deals with three yogas. One is called the Karma Yoga, the other is called the Jnana Yoga, and the third is the Bhakti Yoga. I shortly explain those three terms. Karma means activity. Now it's not an ordinary activity, but it's an activity done for the pleasure, ultimately, of the Lord in relation to Him. Bhagavad Gita talks, I use a little bit more Sanskrit term, kama, nishkama karma yoga, which means the selfless activity. You choose the activity according to your nature, but the result is not your consideration. You renounce that activity and offer it to the Lord. That's considered the nishkama karma yoga, or just generally karma yoga. Karma activity, but for the pleasure of the Lord. The Jnana Yoga is a very high level.
An act of service, in other words.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The Jnana Yoga is actually a very difficult one. And Krishna tried already in the beginning to explain that to Arjuna, but you could see Arjuna is not on the level of Jnana. Jnana Yoga is when you're fully able to renounce the attachments to this material world. And your activity happens actually after you're illuminated, to use a more modern esoteric terminology, in your mind. Your attachments to sensual pleasures in this world is gone. You not have to purify yourself through selfless activities, as the karma yogi does, but in your mind you're illuminated, you understand your spiritual nature, and you have an ability to communicate with the spiritual higher nature through your mental, spiritual, intellectual abilities.
When you reach that point, you've just about arrived, right? You're probably not going to come back into this world. If you've reached that point.
A pure karma jnana yogi is certainly not attached to this world, and his goal is also not to remain in this world, but go beyond. The third element, which is actually, if you look at the Gita, embedded in the middle, is the bhakti element. Some people question that, why is bhakti in the middle? You could say first, of course, Krishna talks about all the yogas practically all over. But if you want to generalize the Gita, the first six chapters are mainly about karma yoga, because that was Arjuna's level. That's what he could achieve, this nishkama karma, this selfless work. Jnana is at the very end, is the renunciation. And in the middle is bhakti. And often people questioned why bhakti, the most confidential, the devotional activity, where you have totally selfless motivations. In karma, you choose your work, but you renounce the fruits. In Bhakti Yoga, which is the center between the six chapters in the beginning discussing Karma Yoga, and the last from the 12th to the 18th chapter, the Jnana Yoga aspect is Bhakti, devotional. And Bhakti in that sense means you don't choose your activity. You're depending on the Lord, and whatever you do only for His pleasure. It's a very confidential, a very actually difficult aspect of the yoga ladder. That's also why it's considered the highest ladder or element of that ladder. That when you're able to surrender your ego, your personal desires, your personal motivations, and just act out of love for the pleasure of the Lord. And that confidential highest element of yoga is embedded in the middle, protected by jnana and karma.
You say it's a confidential, the confidential form of yoga. Does that mean that it requires us, or the practitioner, to open his or herself to Krishna's desires? How does one know what Krishna wants of one?
the qualification in order to be able to experience bhakti or understand Krishna, there are two methods. The traditional one, of course, goes through the spiritual master, which is an important element in the Vedic tradition. The spiritual master represents Krishna and could reveal to you what you're lacking and maybe what you're needing to do in order to please Krishna. There is the other element that devotees themselves have opened them up so much in the line of Krishna. The dialogue of the Lord in the heart is taking place. They experience, they realize Krishna accompanying them constantly, and they have that communication with him through the heart where the Lord is also situated.
If we take a well-known, certainly in the West, let's look at the Bible for a moment. It's very difficult to understand because it's so allegorical. Some fundamentalists try to take it literally. Bible scholars say this is impossible because it's poetry, it's allegorical. It requires almost an elitist intellectual knowledge to thoroughly understand. How does the Bhagavad Gita read in that respect? Can everyone clearly understand the messages?
You could say it's simple for the simple and complicated for the more sophisticated and complicated. Krishna talks of qualities of purity and envinessness, so to say, free of envy. The reason why bhakti is considered the most difficult and the most intimate and confidential is because it's based on love. And love is, of course, a word we use all the time here in the West and think we are driven by love, and when we are attached to a person or appreciate a person, we think it's love, but love is something much more deep, something which has to be developed generally, especially when you talk about love of God over many years, maybe many decades, maybe even over many lifetimes. Because love requires two things mainly: the knowledge of the person, which develops in the case of God in full faith, and the spontaneity. If you're in love with something or someone, nothing could deviate you from that love. Someone could come with $1 million and promise you that. Someone can offer you the biggest job in the universe. Because your heart speaks that clear and natural language. I'm with that person and I'm in love with that person, and there's nothing superior, not all the money in the world. As even the Beatles sang in the 60s, money can't buy me love. And of course we have maybe some glimpses of love here in this world, some reflection, but the highest and the deepest and the ultimate love is love for God, love for Krishna. But that has to be developed, and certain qualities, material, mundane qualities, are first have been given up, and Arjuna had to go through that process. As we discussed beforehand, he had wrong motivations why he didn't want to fight. And in order to understand bhakti, one has to actually come to the level of selfless work first, knowledge then, purity. And then when the purity is there, love can develop. Love is not a cheap thing.
Before we continue, what happened to Arjuna? What did he decide? What was the product of this dialogue?
It took Krishna, you could say, maybe 17 chapters till Arjuna was clear and understood. And after Krishna explained from social perspective, religious perspective, philosophical perspective, spiritual perspectives, and even metaphysical perspectives, he told to Arjuna in the last chapter, one of the last verses, "Now Arjuna, I told you everything, the secrets of the secrets. Think about it deliberately and do what you feel is right." And Krishna kind of walked away. He left it up to Arjuna. It's his decision. He told him what he felt he had to tell, but now it's up to Arjuna. And then Arjuna made that famous statement, "Krishna, by your grace, all my doubts have gone, and I'm ready to act according to your desire." And Arjuna fought the battle, but with a different motivation and with a different desires. Because his purpose was not victory. His purpose was not to get a good name. His purpose was actually to fulfill his duty, regardless of the outcome. And actually, with that activity, please Krishna, if it's Krishna's desire.
This dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna is somehow reminiscent of, in importance, in magnitude as in Christianity, the Sermon on the Mount. Do you see parallels there?
I heard there are parallels. Mahatma Gandhi said there are parallels. I'm afraid that I'm not able to really see them because I'm not so much aware of it. I know the first two phrases maybe and the rest I don't know. So I'm a bad Christian in that sense.
Of course, whenever we pick up a book, no matter what the book, we first look at the author. Who put down the Bhagavad Gita?
According to the tradition, what the Gita, so to say, says itself, modern critical scholars may have a different view. There has been a literally incarnation of Krishna who got the job. For those people who cannot remember, just by hearing from a spiritual master, from the right sources, things were written down. His title is Vyasadeva, and that changes in every new millennium or whatever new time frame, another personality gets that job. So Vyasadeva, the present name is Krishna Dvaipayan, that literally incarnation of God, got that job to write that Gita down. But he, as I indicated before, all the Vedic literatures are mainly conversations, questions and answers. And he had the ability to recall them at any time and recite them to interested disciples and people like that. So he is, because that's more interesting. If I describe what happened to Bob, that's one element. But if I can write down a dialogue you had with someone where you describe what happened and he asks questions, but tell me, wait a minute, Bob, there was something else happening there and I'm curious about this point and please tell me more about that. It's much more interesting to read a dialogue than just hear a summary of something. So that's why Vyasadeva was quoting conversations on the Bhagavad Gita and on the Mahabharata, which then became that part of Vedic literature. And that is the same with the other texts as well.
In any kind of religious literature, the question always arises, how can we be sure of the accuracy of what is reported?
Judged by the result. You could look at it as some theoretical statements, laws, God-given, a God-given manuscript, how to live in this world. You act according to that theoretical description, where you maybe assume it may be God's words or not, and then judge by the result. In the Bible, you have some statements, I know, judged by the fruit of the tree. In Sanskrit, it's called palena parichyate. It's the same word. The fruits actually tell whether it's true or not.
Can anyone, regardless of their religious background or particular persuasion, get something from the Gita?
I very much hope so. And it shows also, after the Bhagavad Gita has been translated the first time in the 17th century into English and even in other languages, now it's in over 80 languages available, how people all over the world, maybe they remain Christians or whatever, could get an inspiration, spiritual inspiration. I very much look at the Bhagavad Gita as universal language of God, which has been presented at a certain time, the certain circumstance. We are aware, a very dramatical, tragic circumstance in India. However, its content is universally applicable for everyone.
Perhaps the reading of the Bhagavad Gita, the study of it, could actually enhance one's personal religious convictions.
That's the idea, because ultimately God is neither Christian nor Hindu nor Muslim. He manifests in different ways according to our consciousness, circumstances, level of understanding, and the purpose of our life is a journey back home, back to Godhead.
And no previous knowledge or level of sophistication is required. Anyone will find something in it for them without being a scholar.
The Sanskrit word is samutkanta, which means if you're serious about spiritual development, you can get it. But that's the qualification which is required, your seriousness. Otherwise, academic knowledge may help, may not help. Can also be a destruction if you are too much analytical and not maybe understand from the spiritual soul level. But if you're serious, you'll get there.
Well, all I can say is proof is in the reading. We hope that some people will pick it up and have a look.
And more than in the reading is the proof in the acting accordingly. And then that brings results.